Coming up next, we'll be taking aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. You're tuned to New York's radio voice for peace and justice, WBAI.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, January 21st, 2003. The confrontation with the Palestinians is an existential, cancerous threat to Israel, according to Israeli Defense Force Chief of Staff Moshe Yaalon. So begins an article by Ari Shavit in Haaretz, entitled The Enemy Within. In the first interview by Chief of Staff Moshe Yaalon, when he assumed his post in July 2002, Yaalon attacked the Israeli pathology of self-blame. What he said particularly is that the characteristics of the Palestinians, which he considered a threat, are invisible, like cancer. When you are attacked externally, you see the attack. You are wounded. Cancer, on the other hand, according to Yaalon, is something internal. Therefore, I find it more disturbing. He said he maintains that the Palestinians are a cancer. My professional diagnosis is that there is a phenomena here that constitutes an existential threat. And what is Yaalon's solution? He says there are all kinds of solutions to cancerous manifestations. Some will say it is necessary to amputate organs, but at the moment, I am applying chemotherapy. Zionism Unmasked. The Meaning and Logistics of Transfer, Part 2.
The real character of this account, which is in the website Facts of Israel, and is a defining website and promotion of official Israeli both policy and propaganda, and reflects the series of articles in Haaretz, as you were mentioning, Maya. The essence of this is to revisit the concept that the very existence of the Palestinian people represents a threat to the Israeli state. And I think it's important to understand that the defining of Palestinian existence as an existential threat to the state of Israel reflects the entire concept of Zionism as a colonial ideology from its inception. And every major political expression of Zionism, from the revisionism of Jabotinsky and the Likud to the labor Zionists, have reiterated that theme, no matter the coloration for the goyim, for the outside world.
Yes, Ralph. Lieutenant General Moshe Yaalon is from the labor Zionists. In fact, he is a kibbutznik, like Ariel Sharon. Yaalon was the commanding officer of the paratroops, the Sayeret, the so-called reconnaissance unit that took place in Operation Litani in southern Lebanon. The Sayeret are what you call the special forces of the IDF. And in fact, Moshe Yaalon, who's called Bogey, was the commander of the Sayeret Matkal, which led the liquidation of Palestinian leader Abu Jihad. And he was the commander of the West Bank Division in 1992, which was suppressing the Palestinian people, destroying the infrastructure and destroying their existence. Now, here we have the labor Zionists, Bogey Moshe Yaalon, who, along with Ariel Shalom, are the authors of 48-2.
Or Ariel Sharon, Maya. Sharon.
Yes, Ariel Sharon of 48-2. Ralph?
look at how the man is described in Haaretz, as a humanist, a liberal, a democrat, and a seeker of security and peace. Smart, intelligent, brilliant, tough but not cruel, demanding but not macho, fastidious, though a bit square. He is the iconic Israeli, says the former platoon commander and current speaker of the Knesset, Avraham Berg. He's described as a person of purity, like the precious metal, a nature reserve of Israeliness. Now, this encomium, which is almost embarrassing in its flatulent flattery, is expressive of a very important reality. As Israel Shahak, the late and distinguished chairman of the Israeli Committee on Civil Rights, had so well documented, the kibbutzim were indeed the reserve for the most relentless special forces and killer squads of the Israeli army, and the Labor Party, no less than the Likud, were the genesis of the official units that were engaged in the liquidation of the Palestinian presence in the land of Palestine. But I would like for a moment to anchor the account of the cancer of Palestinian existence and the defining way in which Yaalon describes the Palestinians, because he states that existentially they will never accept, they will never be accommodated to an exclusively Jewish state in the land of Eretz Israel. And when he is asked whether, when he refers to that, he was speaking of the areas of the West Bank and Gaza, and whether indeed those are not occupied territories, he says indeed they are not. The very notion of their being occupied begs the question, because these are the territories that are inherently promised to the people of Israel, and they are exclusively a Jewish preserve. And he says, certainly since the year 2000, he says, if the term occupation had any relevance at all, it lost it in the year 2000, when the State of Israel put a proposal on the table that was supposed to get the Palestinians off our back. But instead, they stabbed us in the back, and they are attached to our back, and they will continue to stab us. And what is he referring to? He is referring to the inability of Arafat to deliver the liquidation of the Palestinian movement in the form of permanently denying the right of return to the 5 million Palestinian refugees, the people who were ethnically cleansed and driven out of Palestine. And the refusal of Arafat, because he couldn't, as he said to Clinton, "Do you want to preside over my funeral? How can I sign this document of liquidation? My people will not allow it." And that is the dynamic, because the Central Intelligence Agency, which was organizing the security services of the Palestinian Authority and was guiding Arafat himself in his aspiring acceptance of a Swiss cheese-like Bantustan with a carving up of every little Palestinian community and surrounded by Israeli settlements and roads, he could not deliver this for fear of the uprising of his own population. So much for the pretense that the Oslo and Madrid agreements and the Bantustanization of the remnant of Palestine had anything to do with Palestinian self-determination. And as soon as Arafat was unable to perform the function of being the stooge of Zionist colonization, he was immediately a candidate for elimination, removal, and discardance. And in fact, the jig was up, for now comes the inherent intent of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza from its inception, the implementation of 48-2, the expulsion of the Palestinian people. Nowhere was this better articulated than in the benchmark document of the Zionist movement, the metaphor of iron articulated in Vladimir Jabotinsky's statement in 1923 called The Iron Wall. He said in 1923, and every subsequent political spokesperson, Labor or Likud, revisionist or Labor Zionist, have echoed the sentiments and the analysis of this document. There can be no discussion of reconciliation between us and the Arabs, not now, not in the future. All well-meaning people, with the exception of those blind from birth, understood long ago the utter impossibility of arriving at an agreement with the Arabs of Palestine for the transformation of Palestine from an Arab country to a country under exclusive Jewish control. Each of you has some general understanding of the history and meaning of colonization, states Jabotinsky. Try to find even one example when the colonization of a country took place with the agreement of the native population. Such an event has never occurred. The natives will always struggle obstinately against colonists, and it is the same whether they are cultured or uncultured. The comrades-in-arms of Hernan Cortes or Francisco Pizarro conducted themselves like brigands. The Redskins fought with uncompromising fervor against both evil and good-hearted colonizers, because the natives will struggle against any kind of colonization anywhere at any time. It is inadmissible to any indigenous populace. Any native people views their country as their national home, of which they must be the masters. They will never allow a new master voluntarily, and so it is for the Palestinians. Compromisers among us try to convince us that the Arabs are some kind of fools who could be tricked with hidden formulations of our basic and abiding goals. I flatly refuse to accept this view of the Palestinian Arabs. They have the precise psychology that we have. They look upon Palestine with the same instinctive love and true fervor that any Aztec looked upon his Mexico or any Sioux upon his prairie. Each people will struggle against colonizers, Jabotinsky states, until the last spark of hope that they may avoid the calamity of conquest and colonization is extinguished, and the Palestinian populace will struggle in this way until we have removed the last spark of hope. It matters not what words we use to rationalize or justify our colonization. This colonization has its own integral, inescapable meaning, and let us be clear, it is understood by every Jew and by every Arab. Colonization has but one goal, and that is in the nature of things. To change that nature is impossible, and it is necessary for us to carry on our colonization against the will of the Palestinian Arabs. That condition has existed in the past. It exists now, and it will be sustained in the future. Even an agreement with non-Palestinians represents the same kind of fantasy. For Arab nationalists in Baghdad or Mecca or Damascus to pay so grave a price, they would have to abandon the Arab nature and character of Palestine itself. For we will never give compensation to Palestine, neither the Palestinians or to other Arabs, and therefore any agreement is inconceivable. For all colonization, and even the most restricted, will continue and sustain itself in defiance of the will of this population. It will continue and develop only under the shield of absolute force, which comprises an iron wall through which this people will never break through. This is our Arab policy. To formulate it any other way would be hypocrisy. Whether through the Balfour Declaration or the Mandate, external force is the necessity for imposing in this country conditions of rule through which this population, regardless of what it wishes, will be deprived of the possibility of impeding our colonization administratively or physically. Force will play its role with strength, without indulgence, without relenting, without relief. And in this, there is no meaningful difference between our militarists and our vegetarians. One prefers an iron wall of Jewish bayonets, the other an iron wall of English bayonets. And to the hackneyed reproach that this point of view is unethical, I say, absolutely untrue. This is our ethic. There is no other ethic. As long as there remains the faintest spark of hope for the Palestinian populace to impede us, they will not sell these hopes. Not for any sweet words, nor for any tasty morsel, because this is not a rabble, but a people, a living people. And no people makes such enormous existential concessions on such fateful questions as their survival, except when there is no hope left, until we have removed every opening visible in the iron wall.
Well, Ralph, you notice that Jabotinsky again refers to existential, and here we have, many years later, We have the chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, Lieutenant General Moshe Yaalon, again referring to the existential conflict. And in his candid, revealing interview with in Haaretz, he goes on to say, "Do we have a choice? We must understand. We have returned to the war of independence." Now, last week, we talked about GAMLA. GAMLA is an organization of military, retired military, and the settlers, the people occupying the West Bank and Gaza. And we talked about the six-part revealing logistics of transfer that GAMLA presented July 3, 2002. Now, prior to it, GAMLA had a full-page ad in Haaretz, and it was called The War for the Land of Israel. And what's interesting about this War for the Land of Israel full-page ad in Haaretz is that it predates the interview with the Israeli chief of staff, but it also refers to the unfinished War of Independence. So what we have here is all sectors of the Israeli, the Labor and the Likud, and even far to the right of the Likud, one might say, talking about an unfinished War of Independence and the logistics of transfer. Because what's interesting in this GAMLA ad is that they talk about the Palestinians as a foreign nation. The indigenous people of the land of Palestine are considered a foreign nature, foreign nation, and that the Israelis must secure for the Jewish people, quote, the heart of the country and protect the rest of the state's population.
It's important to remind our listeners that GAMLA is the organization of high-ranking military officers in the intelligence services and the IDF and the special forces linked with the settlers, who have formulated an elaborated plan of transfer, which they state quite candidly reflects the decisions taken by the Israeli government of every political stripe over a period of many decades. And they quote Theodor Herzl, founder of Zionism, who had said so pointedly, "We shall transfer the penniless population outside of the area long gone into the region." And GAMLA quotes Herzl, "It is long past time to say that if the Jews wish to transfer out the Arabs, they will do it. It will not be painless. However it has to be done, the strategy of transfer will be developed, it will be implemented, it will be carried out."
So in the fourth point of the War for the Land of Israel, GAMLA says, quote, "We call for the Zionist Jewish National Front to oppose any proposal for the establishment of an Arab state, no matter how small or how demilitarized, in the western portion of the land of Israel." Now, what they call the western portion includes the West Bank, Gaza, and pre-67 Israel, because GAMLA goes back to the original formulations of Herzl of the Greater Israel, where the eastern portion includes Jordan and sections of western Iraq.
Maya, to understand precisely what this neutral and anodyne language of transfer means in practical terms, the referral to 1948 is a referral to a process of massacring people in their villages from one end of Palestine to the other. Most of the people who are aware of this at all think that the only significant occurrence was in Deir Yassin, where the units of Likud precedent elements of the Stern Gang and of the Irgun, Shamir and Begin Wing of Zionism, carried out their slaughter. But I think it's important for us to remember that every element of the Israeli armed forces was engaged in this process from one end of Palestine to the other. Here's the account of the massacre of the city, the town of Duema, which was described by the soldiers who participated in it, and it was published in Davar, the official Hebrew daily newspaper of the Labor Zionist Histadrut, General Federation of Workers. Quote, they killed 80 to 100 Arab men and women and children in one corner of the village. To kill the children, they fractured their heads with sticks. There was not one home without corpses. The men and women of the villages were pushed into houses without food or water. Then the saboteurs came to dynamite them. Commanders ordered their soldiers to bring women into buildings they were about to blow up. Other soldiers prided themselves on raping Arab women before shooting them to death. Arab women with their newborn babies were made to clean the place for days, and then they were shot along with the infants. Educated, well-mannered commanders who were considered good guys became base murderers, and this not in the storm of battle, but as a method of expulsion and extermination. The fewer the Arabs who remain, the better, unquote. And this theme was elaborated by the labor Zionists, by Abba Iban, by Rabin, by Barak, by every major government of the Israeli state in cabinet meetings. As the Deyot published the accounts of Nathan Yalin Moore in 1968, we have always stated, that the mosques of Harim al-Sharif and al-Aqsa have to disappear. Had it not been for Deir Yassin, Duema, and the operations in the other towns and villages, 500,000 Arabs would be living in the State of Israel. The State of Israel would not have its existential essence. We will never disregard this. We are fully aware of the responsibilities involved. Yes, wars are cruel, but there is no way out. This country will either be Eretz Israel with an absolute and total Jewish control, or Eretz Ishmael. And then, if we do not expel the Arabs one way or another, our state, our colonization, our program will be in vain. Unquote. That is the essence of Zionism. It is genocidal in its fundamental character. As long as the Palestinian people are on the ground, as long as they aspire to their self-determination, as long as they hunger for control over their land, over their resources, over their own daily lives, they will be regarded as an existential threat to the Zionist colonization and their liquidation as a social essence and a social existence on the planet.
A people too many. Ralph had been reading the Jabotinsky and the Massacre at Duema from The Hidden History of Zionism, a book that he authored and that is available from Amazon.com, from us, or at Revolution Books in Manhattan. Now, our program today, Zionism Unmasked, The Meaning and Logistics of Transfer, is the second part of the Taking Aim series. We've talked now about Moshe Yaalon, the chief of staff, about GAMLA, an organization of the military and settlers. Let us look now at the destruction of hope. That is what Rosemary Radford Reuther, writing in the National Catholic Reporter, spoke about the destruction in Jenin and in the other areas of the West Bank. She wrote May 10, 2002, and Rosemary Radford Reuther is a professor of theology at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary in Evanston, Illinois. She said that the destruction of hope is the goal of the Israeli rampage. Quote, the invasion of the occupied territories of Palestine by the Israeli Defense Forces in March and April 2002 has been organized as a rampage aimed at destroying the infrastructures of public and private life. The accounting of damage has only begun, since some of the Palestinian ministries are still occupied by the military. The picture that is emerging is one of systematic vandalism, particularly of information and communication systems. And Rosemary Reuther goes on to describe the destruction of the Ministry of Civil Affairs, the Ministry of Education, the buildings of the Palestinian Legislative Council, the Palestinian National Authority, the Bureau of Statistics, the Ministry of Culture, the Ministry of Health, and even the Chamber of Commerce. In both Ramallah, El-Biri, Jenin. She says that vital records are destroyed, files are dumped out, and file cabinets blown up. The destruction is described by her as gratuitous vandalism and looting, such that all information systems are wiped out, furniture is slashed and broken, graffiti sprayed on walls, toilets stopped up, fecal matter flooding the floors, pictures and hangings broken and slashed, windows broken, money from safes stolen, stores looted, and medical supplies destroyed.
Every objective account of the process of annihilation in the West Bank and Gaza is consistent with this report. The dying truth in Nablus was the account by Mifta and by Rula Sharkawi. And when she described the Palestinian city of Nablus, which she states hardly makes the news anymore, a place known for its vibrancy, its energy, its hospitality, its love for food, its music, is a ghost town. As she stands in the wreckage of what was once the ancient Al-Kasbah, over 1,000 years old, now a pile of rubble amidst dusty, broken furniture, totally destroyed by tanks, by bulldozers, by missiles, by helicopter attack, by daily destruction of every last habitation. The greatest fatality, silently hidden and masked from sight and sound, is this truth. The daily Palestinian realities and voices are drowned by the propaganda machine of the Israelis and by the silence of the world's media. For the past 8 months, 200,000 Palestinians in Nablus have been under Israeli military control, collective punishment for civilians, all basic functions of life arrested, stores destroyed, and those remaining not allowed to open for business, children unable to go to school, food cannot be purchased, employees not allowed to work, people not allowed to leave their homes to visit relatives or friends, or sit outside the front door of the remnants of a destroyed house. Those caught outside during curfew risk being detained or shot. From the child to the elder, everyone imprisoned, treated like a convicted prisoner. And this is the essence of the Amnesty International report documenting the what is called the war crimes in the occupied territories and within Israel itself. Shielded from scrutiny, the Amnesty report documents the torture, the beatings, the disappearances, the demolitions, and the leaving of people to die under the rubble. The example that is given in the Sharkawi report is numbing. The Shuaibi family lived in homes in Nablus's old city. A father, a pregnant mother, their four children, the grandparents, and two aunts. All 10 people and the unborn were buried and crushed alive when their homes were razed to the ground with tanks. I stood outside the wreckage, staring in disbelief at the image of a flattened site in front of me, trying to understand, to make sense of the senseless, to understand the wiping out of a civilian family without a moment's notice, without hesitation, without thought to the humanity that lived within. This is the little continuation of the process through which Palestine was emptied of its populace in the first genocidal wave that allowed for the establishment of the Israeli state itself.
A key aspect of Israeli policy is torture. Torture has been documented by the London Sunday Times, by Amnesty International, by many human rights associations, and by Ralph and myself in a document for the United Nations that we expanded and called Prisoners of Israel.
The original document, we should mention, was prepared at the request of the United Nations on the treatment of Palestinian prisoners in three jurisdictions, inside the Green Line, in West Bank and Gaza, and in Lebanon.
Now, before I go on to give examples of some of this torture, let us remind you that you're listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. Now, the Internet is important because those of you who have friends and colleagues and family outside outside the tri-state region of New York can tell them that they too can listen to Taking Aim by turning on their computer and going to www.wbai.org. We hope you will contact us at Taking Aim at PacBell, that's PACBELL.net, or write to us at P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V as in Victory, A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. And those of you in the New York region can contact our voicemail at 212-209-2953. That's 212-209-2953. Or contact us in California at 707-552-9995. Our program today, the second part of Zionism Unmasked, the meaning and logistics of transfer. Now, in the Amnesty International report, there's an interview with Maher Musa Hussein al-Naqib. He's 25 years old and is paralyzed from the waist down and confined to a wheelchair as a result of two gunshot wounds that he received in 1994 when he was shot and paralyzed by the Israeli Defense Forces. Now, he told Amnesty International that, quote, "When I did not stand, three soldiers took me to my parents' bedroom, closed the door. They tried to lift me under the arms. At the same time as they were lifting me, they were hitting me on the lower legs, hands, chest, and back of my head, using their hands and feet as well as their rifles. They did this for more than half an hour. And during the entire time, they kept telling me to stand. And when I could not, they would hit me. They finally flipped me over onto the floor and began to kick me around the head and all over my body. This went on for yet another 5 minutes. Then they lifted me back up, put me in my chair. I had cuts on my knees and right thigh. And when they put me in the chair, one of the soldiers was standing on top of the bed and put his rifle to my temple. He told me to stand up, but I kept telling him I could not stand. I was then handcuffed with a plastic tie and taken away." Now, this is typical, but it didn't stop there. He was taken to the courtyard and then to the street, and the soldiers then pushed him down the stairs, and he was found unconscious.
Maya, the use of torture as a constant was elaborated upon by the BBC in its extraordinary report on November 3rd, 2000. Qiyam Prison was a detention and interrogation center during the years of the Israeli occupation of Lebanon. From 1985 until the Israeli withdrawal, thousands of Lebanese held in Qiyam without trial were brutally tortured. Most of them died. This is the BBC. Israel has always sought to escape responsibility for what was done in Qiyam. The Amnesty International call of war crimes describing the reality of Qiyam has been ignored by the Israeli officials. Children were tortured. Ali Khazmar was arrested at 14 and detained in 1988. He was systematically tortured for 11 days. Ali Khazmar was kept in Qiyam for 10 years. Riyad Kalakesh, 14 when he was detained, tortured for 11 months, electric shocks admitted through wires attached to the fingertips and the testicles, the beatings, the dousings with hot water, boiling water, cold water, and what was known as the pole, where prisoners were stripped naked, handcuffed and suspended in agonizing positions for hours at a time. Riyad's brother Adel, detained in Qiyam too, tortured. And they hauled his wife Mona and tortured her in his presence. She suffered electric shocks through wires attached to her nipples, spent 3 months in solitary confinement, where she lost her baby from the beatings. A compelling body of evidence that the BBC recounts in this one center of detention, of sustained torment, of Gestapo-like treatment of the victims of Israeli occupation.
Now, on December 31st, 2002, New Year's Eve, the Islamic Association for Palestine, which is in Great Britain, published a report from Hebron. Israeli occupation soldiers last night beat to death a Palestinian teenager and dumped his body at a gas station in downtown Hebron. Eyewitnesses said five Israeli soldiers ganged up on the 17-year-old Imran Abu Hamdiya, beating him savagely on the head using the butts of their guns. He collapsed and died while inside the Israeli Border Police Jeep. That is the Border Police Unit, the notorious torturers. As well, the IAP reports of the toss game, the lottery, as it is termed by the Washington Post, whereby Israeli soldiers force Palestinians to choose the form of torture that they must undergo. These methods include a gunshot in the leg, a severe beating on the head using rifle butts, or broken arms, among others. The way it is done is that the methods of torture are put on pieces of paper and into one of the Israeli soldiers' caps. And then the Palestinians must choose one, and that is what is then proceeded. The toss game, the lottery. And this is done to Palestinians who are stopped at checkpoints or youths who happen to be on the street. Let us look at torture of children. B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, has been documenting torture on the West Bank and Gaza and inside Israel for many years. And they published in July 2001 documentation from October 2000 to July 2001, particularly at the Gush Etzion police station. And they describe torture of children. For instance, Mufid Hamara, age 15 at the time of his arrest, or Ibrahim Zaul, 16, who was blindfolded. The interrogator said, "He was going to electrocute me, and he would die like Ahmed, a friend of his." The interrogators began to beat Ahmed in front of Ibrahim, and he heard Ahmed crying and screaming at the top of his voice. "I asked him to stop. What was it they were accusing Ahmed of doing? Throwing stones." So Ibrahim told them, "I told them I was ready to confess that I threw the stones so that they would stop torturing his friend Ahmed." Then you have Sultan Mahdi. He had his handcuffs tied, his handcuffs put around his hands and his feet and hands tied to a chair's legs. Again, he was asked if he threw stones at army vehicles on the main road. He says, "At first I denied that I did, but two or three of them started beating me in the face and head for 5 hours. Afterwards, one of the interrogators grabbed me and pulled me to the bathroom near the interrogation room, pulled me by the hair, and put my head in the toilet." Head in the toilet? He thought he was going to drown. Instead, he decided to confess. What could he confess? He told them, "I threw 5 stones at a settler's vehicle." They wrote up a detailed testimony and forced him to sign. Torture, extracting from these youths confessions, torturing them until they confess that they did something, whether or not that was actually the case. Mohammed Sabatin, only 14, was beaten in front of his parents. And then they were beating and beating and beating him. They beat him with such force, kicked him around for 5 minutes, and then blindfolded him and took him to a room. He couldn't see, and still four of them took turns beating him. This went on for 4 hours. Then they took a mop stick and kicked him and beat him with the mop and swore and beat him until Muhammad, just a youth of 14, ended up confessing that he threw stones.
Maya, the Israeli prisons, which have always been essentially political prisons, have been an instrument for terrorizing the entire population. Some 500,000 Palestinians were imprisoned in the West Bank and Gaza since 1967 through the late 80s under conditions of sustained torture. And nowhere has this been better documented than in the Israeli press itself. Within the pre-67 borders, namely inside the Green Line, there are 10 prisons, including Kfar Yonah, Ramla, Central Prison, Shata, Damun, Mahane, Mashiyahu, Beersheba, Tel Mond for juveniles, Nafha, Ashkelon, and Nef Terza. 9 prisons were located in the post-67 occupied territories, Gaza, Nablus, Ramallah, Bethlehem, Farah, Jericho, Tulkarm, Hebron, and Jerusalem. And then there are regional detention centers at Yagur, Shalameh, and Atlit near Haifa, Abu Kabir in Tel Aviv, and the notorious Moskabia, the Russian compound, in Jerusalem. In addition, detention centers in Haifa, Acre, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, 18 police stations throughout the state, 40 police outposts in the occupied territories where thousands were detained and subjected to torture. Military installations throughout the country serving as interrogation and torture centers. The most savage of these in Arma HaAbadon, known as the Palace of Hell and the Palace of the End, located at Mahana Tserim near Sarafan. Detention camps erected to maintain the large numbers of Palestinian prisoners scattered throughout the desert areas in the south and the remoter areas of the north, in Megiddo, where Ansar II was housed, in Gaza, in Dahariya, the detention centers notorious for their inhumane conditions and daily routine of torture. The Cutler Report by Yair Cutler, published in Haaretz in 1978 by Israeli journalist Yair Cutler, called prison life in Israel hell on earth. His account is harrowing. Kfar Yonah, given the name of Kfar Yonah, the grave of Yonah, the detention center that terrifies, as Cutler writes, all who pass through its gates. Named Mirat Petanim, or the lair of cobras, the reception awaiting those remanded there is terrifying. The cells are freezing cold and damp. The shabby, torn, and filthy mattresses are crowded. The detainees have nowhere to lie but on the floor. The overwhelming stench of human excrement, sweat, and filth never fades from the locked and bolted cells. In the D-wing, there are 3 rooms in which 18 and 20 detainees are cramped. The central prison of Ramla, the harshest prison in Israel, where people are in isolation cells. Sunlight never penetrates the isolation cells, completely sealed off. A dangling bulb gives off light the entire day long.
You can read more about the Cutler Report in The Hidden History of Zionism or in our book, Prisoners of Israel. Today, Israel has reopened the notorious Ketzio Desert prison camp, and the Palestine Independent Media Center described on Sunday, April 14th, 2002, the report by the Palestine Center for Human Rights about Ketziot. Now, Ketziot is in the Negev Desert and is called an Ansar 3. We've talked about Ansar 1 and Ansar 2, which were used during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and Ansar 3 was opened in March 16, 1988, as there were the increasing numbers of Palestinians who were detained during the First Intifada. Actually, over 200,000 Palestinians were cycled through the Palestinian facilities. Now, in the Negev Desert, the temperatures range from 32 degrees, that's freezing, at night, to as high as 124 degrees during the day.
Maya, this is the characteristic mode of torment, and just to take 4 brief examples from the Cutler Report. Damun, life in Damun. Hell on earth. The living conditions cause revulsion to every visitor that comes to this God-forsaken place. Most are sick. The majority are despairing. The youth wing has even worse conditions, the overcrowding so terrible that the youths can only stretch their limbs for minutes every fortnight, and this interval often missed. Shata, the overcrowding in Shata is so terrible, the stench is felt at a distance, the cells are dark, damp, and chilly. Sarafand, the palace of the end, set behind a high-wire fence seen by all tourists as they drive on the last section of road from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, but 5 miles from Ben-Gurion Airport. The perimeter of Sarafand, which is 10 miles square, the largest army ordnance and supply depot, is the location of the most relentless torture of the prisoners therein. Nafha, the political prisoner, where the inmates rarely survive. The nights extremely cold, the daytime heat unbearable, snakes and scorpions from the cells. The Cuttle Report is a visit to hell.
One aspect of Israeli detentions is administrative detention. And in the past year, there has been a thousand-fold increase. There are 1,000 Palestinians currently in administrative detention. But that's 1,000 at one time. 20,000 Palestinians have been put into administrative detention. That means only on the word of the military. There is no trial. There is no charge. It's 6 months administrative detention with further renewals of 6 months more. No access to attorneys, no access to family, and most of them are in Ansar 3 in the Negev Desert. Now, this includes Palestinian journalists who are working for Reuters, who are working for Agence France-Presse, who are working for U.S. media outlets, journalists, cameramen, anyone who could document what is taking place in the West Bank and Gaza, the assault, the determination for the expulsion, to destroy the infrastructure of the Palestinians, to make life unbearable. But also, targeted assassinations are a key policy of the Israelis, of the Zionists. There have been 80 in the past 2 years alone. Targeted assassinations of anyone who represents an opposition, from the PFLP, from the DFLP, from Hamas, from Fatah, from any wing of the Palestinian militant opposition.
Indeed, Maya, the targeted assassinations are aimed at those who are most articulate, those who are most politically prepared, those who have the capacity for leadership, those who can give voice to the aspirations of their people, those who have devised political programs of response to the permanent occupation and the torment of the Palestinian people, those particularly who reach out to the settler population, the Jews of Israel, with a plan for a society, a democratic and secular Palestine, in which rights will flow from citizenship, in which Jews or Palestinians, Christians or Muslims will live with equal rights, a de-Zionized state. Those are the people who are specifically and deliberately targeted for assassination. The label of terrorist is attacked to any who challenge the legitimacy of the colonial settler state in Palestine. And these Mossad assassination units fundamentally are underwritten, supported, and coordinated not only by the Mossad, but the intelligence agencies of the United States.
Now, United Press International reported just a few days ago that Mossad agents, in a series of interviews, confirmed, and this was confirmed by U.S. intelligence officials, will now be assassinating people throughout the world.
And specifically in the United States, which was confirmed by the new Mossad director, Meir Dagan, who told UPI, diplomatic constraints have prevented the Mossad from carrying out these operations on the soil of friendly countries until now. This has all changed, he added. It was confirmed, as you say, by U.S. intelligence officials, and the policy raises the potential for sustained assassinations in countries with close ties to Israel, and we're quoting from UPI specifically the United States, Great Britain, and Australia.
Now, there have been Mossad assassinations on foreign soil before, notably in July 1973, when the Mossad team shot dead a Moroccan waiter in the Norwegian ski resort of Lillehammer, and turned out he wasn't the person they were even looking for. And there have been other Mossad assassinations and the famous abduction of the dissident Mordecai Vanunu, who had exposed the nuclear research and the development of nuclear weapons at Dimona.
Well, he exposed this, we should be clear, Mordecai Vanunu and was a technician working at Dimona who had a crisis of conscience as he realized that the Israelis were developing neutron weapons, were testing them in Africa, were testing them on civilian populations, were preparing biological and chemical weapons, were designing nuclear attacks on the primary cities of the Arab world, and he went public with the Sunday Times in London. He was drugged, he was kidnapped, he was secreted, he was taken to Israel, and he was sentenced to 18 years imprisonment for disclosure of the reality of the nuclear and biological chemical warfare programs of the Israeli state.
Just as we have with the CIA, which has been carrying out assassinations throughout the world, but did it, we could say, supposedly out of the public eye, so it had been with the Mossad. But now, just as we have in the United States with President Bush authorizing open CIA assassinations with a targeted list, so we have Israel following through, openly saying that the Mossad will carry out assassinations throughout the world. Let us look now, in the short time remaining, at the close connection between the United States and Israel, because Israel serves as an outpost of the U.S. imperialistic designs in the Middle East. And consequently, there is a very close relationship, not only with the military and the IDF and the U.S. military, and also with the development in the arms industry, but also among other security apparatuses such as the police in the United States and the border police and other police services in the Zionist state of Israel. And part of this is led by JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, which, although it maintains nonprofit status, is one of the primary lobbies for the Zionist state in the United States.
It goes far beyond that, as the singular article in The Nation documented. JINSA has been the primary vehicle for the American Enterprise Institute and for the Committee on the Present Danger. It has been the vehicle of Wolfowitz, of Pearl, of Armitage, of Rumsfeld, of the American Enterprise Institute, and Gene Kirkpatrick for the defining of policy, which now has become the centerpiece of imperial design in the Middle East, the invention of the category of terror, the plan to implement the Yehuda Yinon program of the late 70s for the fragmentation of each Arab state in its turn, and the use of direct military force to seize the resources. JINSA has been in the lead of that, and one of the key members of the board was the Central Intelligence Agency Director James Woolsey.
And what JINSA is doing is organizing trips, tours of Israeli law enforcement counterparts from the United States, and among them the former chief of the New York Police Department, who is now the director of security at the Metropolitan Transit Authority, none other than Chief Louis Anemone. He's the director of security, as I said now, of the MTA, and had been the chief of the NYPD. They brought along also the deputy chief from the Los Angeles Police Department, from Orange County, from Baltimore, and also James Woolsey brought to Israel to work closely with the Zionists, the retired Admiral Leighton Smith, who held several key U.S. Navy posts and led the so-called peacekeeping force, the occupying army, in Bosnia.
Maya, the Washington Post reported on January 17th of this year that the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the chief of police in Washington, D.C., have been attending Israeli anti-terrorism preparation schools and a major conference in Tel Aviv on anti-terrorism on the ground. 33 senior law enforcement officials from the United States and Canada, including the chief of police of Washington, D.C., Charles H. Ramsey, the United States Capitol Police Chief Terrence W. Gaynor, and top officials, and I'm quoting from the Washington Post, from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, have been attending an Israeli-organized anti-terrorism conference, quote, to pick their brains and to emulate and to study their tactics. This is the epicenter of terrorism. We are learning how to apply what the Israelis have implemented based on their experience, said Van A. Harp, head of the FBI's Washington field office. It has magnified the need for our partnership, the importance of learning from their methods, from their tactics, from their experience, so that we too can implement these methods in the United States. For Israeli, and this is the Washington Post, and for Israeli National Police Inspector General Shlomo Aharonishki, the host of the four-day conference, these are the main elements of our instruction on anti-terror police work. I call your civilian population a strategic asset in the fight against terror. I say that your methods must be our methods. And on a visit to Jerusalem, during which the group met with Prime Minister Sharon, Capitol Police Chief Gaynor noted that the terrorist threat in Washington was similar to that in Jerusalem, because in Washington we have a diverse group, too, that raises the pressure on an open society. And we must learn how to deal with this, as the Israelis have done.
Zionism Unmasked, the meaning and logistics of transfer. You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net or at 212-209-2953. We'll be with you next week.